Hello, welcome to Call Runner.
Radio.
Oh. Hello, welcome to Call Runner. Today, Richard will be hosting and introducing our guest. Take it away, Richard.
Well, it's Richard Modiano here, and we are talking to Patrick James Dunnigan, who is a poet and an editor. We may get into Patrick's own work a little bit, but we are going to be mainly talking about Rockdow by David Meltzer, his latest book published by Lithic Press. And Patrick, I wanted to ask you, what is the genesis of this book?
The genesis is basically myself and Nicholas Whittington and also Marina Lazera, who were sort of Marina studied with David and Nick knew David. We helped David's widow, Julie Rogers, go through his papers after his passing. And Rockdow, there was a set of galleys that Oyez Press was going to publish back in about 68, and it had never come out. And so we found those galleys, and this was a book that David had wanted to put out but had never been able to. And he put a small section in a little magazine that Nick edited named Americana through the bookstore Bird and Beckett, owned by his family in San Francisco. And so I had those galleys, and then Neely Tchaikovsky suggested to Lithic Press that a book of David should be done. And I threw out some ideas to the publisher, Danny Rosen, and one of those was going through these galleys and putting together a book for Rockdow. And Danny liked that idea.
So did you have to, did any further modifications of the galleys take place, or were they pretty much as?
There was some modifications that had to happen. One thing that David did when he did publish a section of it in Americana was he did something that he did similar to when he would do like a poetry reading, which he would have a big stack of books. And in his teaching, he would always, when he delivered lectures, he would have a big stack of paper. So whether he was giving a poetry reading or a lecture, he would go through and he would kind of like riff through the books or through the stack of paper, skipping pages and different sections. And he seemed to have done the similar thing with what he gave Nick to publish, where he covered about maybe a 60-page section, let's say, of the galleys, but then threw out two-thirds of it and just so kind of just like skipped along his way, cutting here and there. I don't think he meant to leave those things out completely, just that he wanted to kind of cover as much as he could, and he had a limited amount of space because it was a journal excerpt. And then he did make some minor changes to language here and there, which I preserved in this manuscript that I published. And I also tried to, if it was, because he has some reoccurring, like, things he uses that he kind of updated to current myths, to call them current myths, and he was calling them kind of something else slightly different in the original galleys. And so I went ahead and updated them all to refer to as current myths. So some minor things like that. And then the galleys kind of trailed off at the end. There wasn't really a final closure to them per se, and I sort of put a final closure on it. And there was actually a number of addendum-like sections, and we ended up with just keeping three addendums.
So, well, our listeners may not be aware, but this is not strictly a book of poetry that we are talking about. It is a chronicle of popular American culture, specifically musical culture. And since you mentioned the addendum, There's a discographical checklist which has a list of the many songs that David referred to throughout the text, and I have to say it all fits together quite beautifully. Any modifications or say it's I want to say that it's seamless. That's the word that I'm looking for. So it all works together seamlessly. It does not seem like anything, nothing seems out of order or out of place in this. So I would have to say, I have to congratulate you as an editor. Your sensibility was totally in tune with David's, because I see nothing that sticks out, stands out, or rings false in any way throughout this text. And
I appreciate
and listeners,
that.
And listeners, this is a really, it's incredibly dense. It is full of all kinds of references. It is kind of open-ended in a way. It doesn't dictate your response, but as usual with David Melcher's work, it is precise, it is concise, and it is specific. But nonetheless, there is this subtext of, like, make of this what you will. And that sort of invites reader participation. So at least for me, when I was reading it, I was sort of like constructing it with David, so to speak. Or not constructing it, but I was drawn into it. And, you can free associate on it because he gives off ideas like a sparkler gives off sparks. And maybe Patrick, you could give us a sample of what David is doing in this book.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. And there's two checklists of albums in the back of the book, and it's both music that he's citing within the text and music that he doesn't cite in the text. It's just sort of kind of foundational music of rock and roll. And Rock Dow is very much the rock is rock and roll. And this is David's kind of riffing along, listening to the radio stations, listening to the top hits, and reflecting on sort of like what led to rock and roll and where rock and roll is at, even though it's in the middle of it's still happening, because he's writing this, you know, roughly in 65. So what I'll do is I'll just jump into the middle here, just to give a little kind of sense of how he's bouncing off things. This is going to get into the Beach Boys. Los Angeles, Hollywood, and sea-swept environs is the sound of Pacific surf turned into whipped cream, freeway music of teenage sub-dolphins who loiter on beaches or in drive-ins, driving sports cars, hot rods, motorcycles, scooters, whose girls are legendary beauties who litter California beaches until the eye gets bored with such repetitive abundance. An orange juice culture with ritual sports, surfboarding, the sport of ancient Hawaiian kings and princes. Sea imprisoned music, sung by youth facing the end of the American continent with pride and fear. The dreams Medusa mother hear with wings outspread in sunset brilliance above the movie lots, TV lots, record studios. From dark city boxes in the eastern rock pile, the spirit travels west to the great foam rubber Hollywood, the tower facing the Orient with millions of long-haired princes hang their braids down the walls for millions of long-haired princes to grab a hold of and scale styrene walls and embrace before a TV set and phone a Chinese restaurant to deliver the dragon for their dinner. Surrounded by middle-class forts and valleys, Hollywood is the middle class's highest utopian reality. The imagination created Hollywood for the old to uphold as they sit on bus benches in the sun, and for the young to ignore and their woodies headed for the beach, tossing empty country club cans out the window. Bard of the oceanfront, the California teenager of teenage materialism, is Brian Wilson, leader of the Beach Boys. He writes a good 90% of the songs the group performs. His songs sing the glory of the California teenager's white middle-class nirvana in exacting words that describe the bliss of objects. Like Chuck Berry, Wilson is often a vehicle bard. In fact, his major song subjects are love and flight. His sense of the California teenager's scene and dream is precise. Many of his songs deal with drag racing, surfboarding. And from there, he launches in to quoting the lyrics from the Beach Boys song Little Honda. And that sort of gives, and he just kind of keeps on riffing of what the songs of the Beach Boys kind of get him going on. And as you heard, he's tying in with Chuck Berry there, saying like where their debt is owed as musicians.
What is striking about the book is that it is not reduced to just one theme of the aesthetics of music, but rather the entire culture and sociology of that music, and even the circumstances, the material circumstances under which it was produced. He goes into all of this in this book, and that's why I said earlier that it is a very dense text, and because of that, it is both it's a history, and it is a sociology, and it is a critique of popular music of that era. And indeed, the insights that he shows in that particular era are still true. They're still pertinent. Things have changed, sure, but maybe the type of music that people listen to, but the circumstances of its production are pretty much the same, and its effect on our culture at large is also the same. And David nailed it way back there in the 1960s. And what's astonishing, listeners, is that he was, what, 25, 26 when he started this?
Yes, yeah. He's roughly 25, 26. He may have been actually, yeah, he was 28, basically, when by the
okay,
time he finished it.
He was in his 20s. That is the point. He was in his 20s, and he had this tremendous insight at, most people in their 20s, they have to do a few more years of living before they really can see beneath the surface of a lot of things. But, you know, David grasped it right away. And perhaps, you know, for listeners who don't know his biography, at one point he was a child actor in Hollywood. So
that
gave him a precocity for how the industry works. And Hollywood,
yeah,
course,
and he grew up, his parents were involved in the music industry as well.
Yeah.
He was born in Rochester, New York, and his dad was involved, you know, within the television show business, and his mom was, she played an instrument and she sang, and then, you know, they divorced and he moved out to LA with his dad. So yeah, he grew up as part of that whole business. He was around it from a very early age.
And that served him well in his chosen topic. And by the way, listeners, rock Tao, and the Tao part of that is spelled T-A-O. And what David is referencing here is the Tao of the Tao Te Ching, which is the classic Chinese text, the Book of the Way. And Tao here means the way in its original Chinese sense, which is the way of rock. And the rock that we are talking about is rock and roll. So it has this this mythopoeic element to it because of this reference to the Tao or the way. And basically what David is attempting to do in this book, and I think he does successfully, is to show us the way that a particular manifestation of art influences the rest of our culture, becomes part of that culture. I mean, there are so many wonderful passages in the book that go into this. I mean, nothing is left. There is no stone left unturned in this book. And that is why it is such a wonderful read, at least for people who are interested in rock and roll, in the culture of the 1960s, in the politics of the 1960s, because the politics of that era are also referenced throughout the book. And that's another really remarkable thing about this. I mean, And the other thing is this, from the way that I've been describing it, it may sound like it is sort of a dry academic thesis, but from what Patrick just read, you can see that that is not the case.
Let me read another brief passage here where he kind of, you know, discusses capitalism, you know, which is kind of the engine churning this whole society. And I think everything you just said applies just as much to today. And that's the interesting thing about David's text is all this is still happening. The characters change, the songs have changed, but the force driving it continues to this day. So here's a brief passage here. This is in the middle of the Beatles. He had just quoted "Can't Buy Me Love." The creative capitalist is one who makes us forget that we are supporting him. Like all gods, the Beatles sing for their supper. They're in it for the money. Wealth is the ultimate in contemporary Western hagiology. Our myths never retire, substantiating success. by using that Geiger counter that measures cash. The story of gods is also the story of divine capitalism. Religion is the history of corporations. According to its gospel, we must earn whatever we want. Whatever we need must be, one way or the other, paid for. Men support their habits. Only during moments of revolt or creation is man not addicted or habit-bound. Yet successful revolt lays the ground for new habits, a network of new obligations, new duties paid out to the same old union. The revolution is over as soon as your face is printed on sweatshirts worn by the young. And there's so much there. It's almost like everything, you just want to stop for a minute and unpack that sentence before you continue on. But it's quite striking that he's just
he's going after
what is the engine, you know, behind this whole market economy that is the art scene of the music.
And throughout the book, there is he establishes this dialectic between art and capital throughout the book, and how unwittingly some of the art that is underwritten by big music industries tends to make people critical of those very same industries, of the very same mechanisms that, you know, make us sing for our supper. And another wonderful insight in this book, that's part of this book. And can you tell our listeners, one of the other threads in David's work is his interest in myth and legend from both East and West. And it's clear that it's part of this book as well. But can you tell our listeners, as a former student, as somebody who knew David, what drew him to that?
I think he was just drawn to look for the, you know, the questions of life, right? I mean, that's what draws anyone towards any of those religions, and that they are unanswerable is what always kept him going. David was the kind of mind that was never turned off, that was never not interested, that always wanted to know more, and that related things together. So, you know, if you brought up something, he could bring up something else and also ask you about what you know, and relate it to what you were bringing up. But then, you know, he always usually knew what you were bringing up, but he didn't then lay that knowledge on you. He just kind of opened up more knowledge for you and for himself by kind of wanting to know what your take on that knowledge was that you were thinking about. But I think he was just constantly drawn toward those answers that are ultimately unanswerable.
And as a teacher, from my conversations with him over the years, I mean, I was never his student, but whenever I talked to him, he was always learning something. And I find that the best teachers are people that are still finding things out and learning themselves. And even if you sat down for a serious conversation with him, it was more like a Socratic dialogue. He had a vast, his information was vast and endless, it seemed to me. But he never hammered you over the head with that. He listened to what you were saying, and he sort of expanded that, or he corrected it. I mean, that was my experience from talking to him over the years. And I always came away, you know, feeling refreshed. I mean, it was like, I can't remember who it was said about, but it was like, after talking to David, I felt like a plant that has been watered.
Yes, yeah.
I can't take credit for that expression. Somebody else used it in another context, but that's how I felt. I mean, I said, David, do you have some references that I can pursue on that? Oh, sure, Richard. Yeah, here. And he would rattle off some titles, and I'd note them down. So,
yeah, he was an endless source. Those.
Yeah, that was the other thing about reading Rock Dow. It was like being in a conversation with him.
Very much so, yeah. You know, and one thing that I sort of compare it to, too, in my introduction is Amiri Baraka's Blues People. And that's kind of Baraka's kind of first critical book. And he wrote a number of critical books, but he's looking at the blues tradition you know, very much from his African-American perspective. But I think that this is David's take, kind of as, you know, especially coming out of the show business side of New York and approaching rock and roll music is very similar. And one thing that Barack ever remarked about his own book was he was saying that he was admittedly and very openly shooting from the hip. And I think that's David is very much shooting from the hip with this book as well, which is one of the reasons I think it is like a conversation, because these ideas were, he was just kind of still developing these ideas. And going through the galleys, it was even more like that, because there was areas where, I mean, it's in six parts, and those six parts, I kind of discovered those in the galleys. They weren't immediately evident, but it appeared that there were actually some that he did break, and he did say, this is the next thing. And then once I laid it out, I could see how that was clearly an end and then how he was moving on. But it was like he was making the book up as he kind of went along, it really felt like. And the other thing about the galleys was that there were two sets, because one set was on legal paper, they were all on legal paper, but one set was just, it was vertical running the length of the legal paper. And then halfway through, suddenly the page orientation changed. And so you had two pages on the legal size paper, two different pages that then, and so it was like, I think he had kind of was working it, and he had notes throughout the galleys as well in handwritten form. So it was very much something that he was just kind of working his way through. So I don't know what he would have done with the book if he had had the opportunity, because I think he may have kind of tried to space it out more. But it is very much David, an ultimate David book. This is probably, you know, the book of David, I think, where you really get all of him, more so than so many other books of his, where it's like he's really zeroing in on one element of something. Here you really get him going all over the place, as you're kind of saying, but not in any erratic sense, in a very just kind of following the train of his thinking as it develops about the subject that he's focused on.
Yeah, well, that's why that is the Tao part of it, and the Tao is this continuity that branches off in all different directions, but it, ultimately it comes back to the source over and over again. So you know, that's definitely part of the book, and part of the way that, at least in my experience, that was the way that David thought. And your reference to getting the whole range of his interests and ideas in one book, yeah, that is true. I remember when we had the publication reading for When I Was a Poet at Beyond Baroque, when I was still director there, he did read that title poem, which is also the poem When I Was a Poet, was, you know, very, very revealing. And it was sort of autobiographical, but not strictly autobiographical. It sort of went over into all of the other stuff that he concerned himself with. It was sort of insightful. The poem itself had wonderful imagery. It had the music going for it, and most importantly, it had the ideas. So, I mean, David Meltzer is certainly one of the deepest poets around, and his poetry is very accessible. I don't want to drive listeners away from David Meltzer, making you think that this is something that you're going to rack your brains trying to figure out. No, you can get it. It's there. You have to delve into it. I mean, it's like, it sort of works on a couple of levels. There's sort of the surface level, which is very engaging. You can learn a lot. But there is a sort of an inner level, the meaning of what he's trying to do, and the connections that he is making. So you have to. It takes a little effort. I mean, any good text takes some effort on the part of the reader in order to get the most out of it. But the entree into that is very easy. It's very graceful. The way you can get, especially in Rockdow, because anybody that reads the book will have heard at least some of these songs, and to get a take on this music by somebody who is both sensitive and knowledgeable is really enriching, I think. So these were some of the these are just go ahead, Patrick.
Oh, and you can really dip into Rockdale. It's not something you have to just, you know, I mean, it definitely doesn't invite you to just barrel through it, you know, in one sitting. You don't have to read it from beginning to end. It doesn't have that sort of narrative arc. Only the final section, really, which is a great little kind of mini short story about going to an actual rock and roll concert, to kind of see the spectacle in the flesh, as it were. He goes to a Rolling Stones concert with the Hollies, who ran Oya's Press. And so that's sort of fascinating, too, that they were going to be publishing this book. And then they go to the concert together. And Lou Welch, the poet, the famous, you know, pal of Phil Whalen and Gary Snyder, associate of the Beat Poets, he was their cab driver, because Lou Welch was driving cab at that time in his life. And so it kind of that opens up the final section of him driving David and Tina, his wife at the time, and the Hollies to go hear the Rolling Stones. And it's not just the Stones. There's several bands that open for them. And so you get David's take on just kind of being in that. And it's at the Bill Graham Auditorium, right down there at Civic Center in San Francisco. But you get his take on being immersed into that kind of culture where the girls are freaking out, they're screaming, and they're trying to, you know, get a better seat. And they're talking to their boyfriends about, you know, what they think of the Stones and who's their favorite Stone. So that's really the only part that has a straightforward narrative. But the rest of it, you could just kind of dip in at almost any point and just kind of, because, you see some lyrics you recognize, and then you just kind of go from there. And you might just get taken up by something. Let me read another little passage here.
No, this is on
Elvis. This is on Elvis Presley here. Because the other thing, the book, it kind of takes it by regional territories of the country a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like the previous section was the Beach Boys, so it's like California. And then this section is kind of like on the South. And then there's like a Detroit section. But they're not all clearly delineated, but that is one aspect of it. Along with then, there's a whole section on just teen magazines and the phenomenon of rock and roll teen magazines and of advertisements. But here he is on Elvis. Elvis was wild and tame. Life and fortune tamed him. He is unmarried, surrounds himself with a group of friends and colleagues from Nashville who keep Elvis amused. Presley doesn't smoke or drink. And all reporters who interview him say that he's polite, courteous, and totally impersonal. Two homes, one in Nashville, the other in Hollywood. Both are furnished with pinball machines, jukeboxes, soft drink bars, TVs, stuffed animals, books, toys. And he plays touch football with his buddies, or they'll sing together and goof off within the fenced police land of his two homes. And here he quotes from A Big Hunk of Love, "You just a natural-born beehive filled with honey to the top, but I ain't greedy, baby. All I want is all you got." Elvis is in Fame's prison, and he is a docile, willing prisoner, kept amused by his friends who are, in most ways, no different than he. He is served by his facsimiles. His revolt was a success. His wild earth dance is over. His imitators and followers are rarely heard today. The revolt's done when the revolutionary force becomes an established institution, itself a target for a future revolution. Today, Presley is a blank paper for the imagination's marker to work on. The animal god, violent prince, the adolescent's ideal sex image, has been trapped and lives content in captivity. Which then, if you think of, you know, and this is 65, so, you know, Elvis is kind of in the middle of his career here, and David's kind of capturing exactly where Elvis is going to stay.
That's exactly right. That is the sort of the transitional period in Presley's career where he was becoming more of an establishment figure. He hadn't become the Vegas Elvis yet, but you could see that he was sort of on his way there. And I think David sort of captured that notion.
Yeah.
And I
think that's something that shows is how much he was really his fingers, like David kind of had his fingers on everything at once. This is something that Rockdale sort of shows, because I think he's gathering that information about Elvis by reading everything that was out there on Elvis, all the different magazines that were out there, all the different stories that were being written, not just one thread, because there wasn't just like one go-to book on Elvis.
Yeah, well, there is, of course, the other part of I wanted to mention to our listeners, there is a time retrieval quality to this book. And that's so a tremendous interest. Anybody who's followed rock and roll, I mean, you, whatever generation you are in, you know, you have this whole past history of rock and roll that is staring you in the face, and it is beautifully probed, analyzed, and presented to you in this book, Rock Doll. We are just out of time. I've been talking to Patrick James Dunnigan, the editor of David Meltzer's Rock Doll, available from Lithic Press. If you have not heard of David Meltzer, I would say this book is a wonderful entree to his work. You can get it. You can order it directly from Lithic Press or at your local independent bookstore, or as a last resort, you can go to Amazon. But I do recommend most strongly that you buy it from Lithic Press and let them know that you want to read more books like this. And frankly, listeners, as I've said so many times before, it is the small presses like Lithic Press that are taking chances with poetry and with cutting-edge writing. So, again, Patrick, many thanks for your time, and I've enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you, Richard. I have too.
And I guess that's it for now.
Okay, that's it. We're good.
Yeah.
Okay.